Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey everybody, you're about to listen to one of two year-end episodes featuring our host Renee Stubbs, as well as cultural attaché Andrea Pekovic. The two of them go deep on first the women of 2023 and then the men. We'll be posting them in the next couple of days, but I wanted to call your attention to our newsletter because those of you who are living in New York City have an incredible opportunity to come see us live. We're doing a live podcast and holiday market here in New York City. Check out our newsletter. We'll be announcing it. You can RSVP. There will be prizes. There will be giveaways. There will be guest appearances. And there will be an incredible holiday market where you can grab some racket stuff for the loved ones in your life. Our racket newsletter can be subscribed to at our website. Don't miss it. See you soon.
If they get an inflamed hoof, they have to be killed.
Okay, 1, 2, 1, 2. Okay, it is, I guess, chapter 2 of the roundup of the year of the best top 10 players on that WTA Tour and ATP Tour. Last week we did it where we talked about the women. I didn't even know if we're going to say last week. We'll just say last pod was talking about the women, wrapping up the women, how happy we were about everything that happened last year on the, or this year still, on the WTA Tour. But I am joined once again by the one and only great, fantastic, amazing, beautiful, greatest eyebrows of all time, my favorite German, queen of the writing, best author as a former professional tennis player.
That's very specific.
Andrea Pekovic.
It's like, you're the best writer who used to be a tennis player on the women's side from Darmstadt.
From Darmstadt.
Thank you very much.
Listen, the thing is, it's funny, is that I wish I could write like you. But then again, you write in German, so I don't even know how well you write.
Yeah, that's I always say that my boyfriend, Jesse, he thinks I'm Hemingway, but he doesn't read German, so I could literally tell him whatever I wanted.
I have read many of your articles in the Racket magazine, and so I know that you're a very good writer. So
thank you very much. My favorite compliment that you gave me was my eyebrows. People seem to neglect the form and shape of my eyebrows. They're the only redeeming quality about myself. So thank you for shouting that.
Great skin.
And thank you.
Great skin.
Oh, thank you, Renee. Now, yeah. Enough about me. Okay. Let's talk about you. You have some
to reciprocate by saying, and you are, you know, whatever about me, but it's fine. It's fine.
I will weave that in later. But okay. What I'm very excited about, you have some great news for everyone. We mentioned it on the last pod, but we couldn't give 100% certainty. But there is exciting news about the live podcast recording.
Yes, Caitlin and I, sadly, you will not be in town because you're going back to the Deutschland, back to the mother country for Christmas. But on December 17th, for those that are fans of the pod, fans of tennis in the tri-state area or wherever you're from, you can jump onto the old train too from anywhere in the East Coast. We are having a live podcast December 17th. We have some goodies to give away. We have some special guests that hopefully will be coming on board. Sadly, not Petko. She's gone. But we are, so block out the 17th of December in the afternoon. We're going to have a great live podcast here in New York City in the Gramercy Park area of New York. We will give out more details when it gets a bit closer. But we're going to have some fun stuff to give away And we did a live podcast, Petco, you didn't come to that, in Wimbledon years ago, and it was so much fun. And we had interactive stuff with the crowd, and it was great. So December 17th, if you're a fan of tennis, you live in the tri-state area, Caitlin Thompson and I will be doing the Renee Stubbs Tennis Podcast live from New York. All right, let's get to the men's wrap-up.
Let's get to the men's, and just as a little addendum to the whole live podcasting, there will be prizes.
Yeah, I already said that, gifts and prizes.
There will be, but that's important to stress out, because nobody's coming because
stress
of
out.
You.
Stress out.
Because everyone is coming because of the prices. Let's get into it. I enjoy it. That's why I'm taking over. It's not to...
Because you just are that person.
I am. No, I enjoy hearing your thoughts on tennis. And this may be my compliment, my German way of complimenting you, is I can't say you're great, you're amazing. I have to give it through little cues here and there. And I enjoy your thoughts on tennis very, very much. And that's why I somehow weirdly turned into the interviewer on the Renee Stubbs Tennis Podcast. but let's get into it. Great season.
Yeah, great season.
With some amazing rivalries. We talked about it on the last pod. A new rivalry may be coming up between Djokovic and Jannik Sinner. Carlos Alcaraz and Novak Djokovic played some incredible matches. But let's get straight into it. Number one in the world. Best player of the year, best player of the season, best player of the decade, really.
Best player of all time.
Novak Djokovic, 7 titles, 3 Grand Slams, ATP finals.
And the finals of Wimbledon.
And almost won that Wimbledon finals as well. So he was very close to winning the Grand Slam. What did you make of his season? He played much less than he did in the last years, which was probably...
Due to not being vaccinated. Because he still couldn't come, remember, to Indian Wells in Miami.
Oh, I forgot that.
Right,
that didn't get lifted
until May.
But just in
May.
General, also when he broke the record at 377 weeks of being number one in the world, he broke, I think, Steffi Graf's record with that.
Yeah.
He just stopped playing small tournaments right away, which I love. Okay, so I'm going to say I hear your thoughts, I have to say, I am so here for villain era Novak Djokovic. That's all I ever wanted
Stop
of him. That's all I ever wanted of him. I always wanted him to take this role and be F you to everyone. I'm so much better than everyone, and I'm going to own it. I'm going to yell at the audience. I'm going to blow kisses at people who try to disturb me, and I'm going to win it all. That's all I ever wanted from him. So I'm so happy he's leaning into that villain era.
Yeah, you have said that forever.
I've said that forever.
Forever.
How long? You're for 10 years I've been saying that.
All of these guys like Rafa and Roger, and you know, they're so well behaved on the court. People love them, and you know, they just want to love them. And then there's this bipolar Novak, right, where he's like trying to have everyone love him, and then he's telling them to F off, and then he's kissing to them. And it's like you have always said, just embrace that about you. You're never going to be that person that's going to be well behaved on the court and all that sort of. It's just not in your nature to be like that all the time. He's an incredible loser. He's unbelievable at the net. When he shakes hands, it's almost like he becomes these guys like older brother or father, because he's so much older than some of them now. But when it comes to actually playing the match, he's like, fuck you guys. Screw the crowd, screw everyone. And it's like you have been wanting him to just embrace that.
Yes.
And he does. And a lot of people now are actually saying, who's he going to find in the crowd to yell at?
Yeah.
Because that fuels him. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh my God, it's true. It look what he did in, I think it was it Paris? It was the tournament that he won when he basically was egging the crowd on. Like, yeah, come at me, come
in
at
Paris.
Me.
In Paris.
And then he didn't lose a point.
He didn't lose a point.
I was like, what is he doing? He's crazy. And then he didn't lose a point. I'm like, that's just him. He just needs that edge, that edge that makes him just want to never miss a ball. And that's what happens. And he's unbelievable. It's incredible.
He's unbelievable. And I will give you another theory. We talked about the theories I set up while going to sleep, I guess. And one of my theories is that athletes are driven by three things not all at the same time, but each athlete, and there are combinations, but each athlete is driven by some kind of thing. I feel like Roger Federer was driven by the love for the sport. He has that very zen nature, right?
He always learned that because he was a maniac when he was a kid.
Yes, but he, you know, he always loved the sport. You can feel that he just, you know, enjoys a little bit like the Anshaber. He needs to have the joy for tennis, right? That's why he hated playing Nova, because he takes the joy out of the tennis, right? Yeah. He just grinds you down if he needs to. And then you have, for me, this is Iga Świątek and Rafael Nadal. They are driven by anxiety. They are so scared to lose. Rafael Nadal has won 14 Grand Slam, Roland Garroses. He comes out in the first round of the French Open playing a lucky loser, and you can see in his face that he's scared to lose. Like, every single person out there is like, Rafa, you might lose a game. You're not going to lose the match, but he believes that he will lose. And that's what drives him, because he's so intense, because he's afraid that he's going to lose. And the third player, and I was a little bit like that, that's why I identify with Novak so much, is driven by revenge. It's like, you don't believe in me? Oh, I'm going to show you. And I think Serena was similar to that.
I think Serena
and Novak have something very similar in their mentality.
Yes.
Because Serena and Venus were never believed in. They were always ostracized. They were always like, oh, these girls from Compton, they can't win anything, or they are not going to make it.
Well,
and they
I think
like,
Serena had it more than Venus because
she was also the smaller sister.
And she was always for a long time, was very much not in the spotlight. Venus had all the spotlight on her, and Serena was just the little sister, and I think Serena had a bit of a chip on her shoulder because Venus was getting all the attention and was the older one, and no one was really looking at her. And so I think that chip was born due to the fact that she was born second in the family.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like Maggie Maleva had a little bit more of a chip on her shoulder. The older sisters were not like that.
You talked about it. You coach Karolina Pliskova, who has a, some said, more talented sister, the lefty Kristina.
That's
but
right.
Karolina turned out to be the better one, because she said everyone believed more in Kristina. They thought she was going to be the better one.
Because she was lefty. Absolutely. And so Karolina had a chip on her shoulder.
I think that is Novak's drive. And I think he wasn't away, or he didn't want to embrace it, because he thinks of himself as a better person, because he is. I know him for such a long time. He's a great person. But I always said the quality of your human being is not the same as your tennis player persona.
No.
That's something, you can be the biggest asshole as a tennis player. It has nothing to do with who you are off the court.
Yeah.
And I think he wants to believe in himself as being a good person, so that wouldn't go together. And I think now he's come to realize my tennis player persona is my tennis player persona.
Yeah, true.
And Novak is Novak. This has nothing to do with each other. So I think he's much more able to embrace that. I'm going to show you. I don't care everyone is against me. And one more thing I have to say about Novak, and I think I tweeted it out once and I keep repeating it, but I think the reason people have trouble, or casual tennis fans have trouble giving him the respect that he deserves, is because he doesn't have a style of play like Roger has or Rafa
has.
That's
so true. Yeah.
He is adaptable. That is his style of game, that he's adaptable. Just think about that US Open final. He played serve and volley every second or third point because Medvedev is 17 feet behind the baseline. So he adapts. He's a tactical genius, and he has the skill to execute every single game plan that he makes up for himself. And so he adapts to every player. He will grind down a Roger. He will take the ball early against Carlos Alcaraz. He will hit hard against Rafa, and he will beat them. And I think because he has that, he's like water, right? He flows through your fingers. You try to grab him, but you can't, because he's always different. He's like a shapeshifter. And I think that's why it's difficult for casual tennis. But I think that's why it's difficult for casual tennis fans. And this is really important to stress, because I do think that the tennis fan, the passionate tennis fan, has gotten around to the fact that this is the greatest player of all time, maybe the greatest athlete of all time. But I think for the casual tennis fan who just watches the Grand Slams and the majors, it's hard to grasp Novak because he plays so different every time. And I think he's in art, they would say he's an artist, right? Where like all the artists respect him, but the commercial fan base is like, oh, what does he have that we don't, you know?
Yeah, oh, I think that's really well put. That's the first time someone's ever explained it like that. And I think that's so true. Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, listen, my on-court persona was not how I am off the court.
Exactly.
I mean, you were the perfect example.
Hey,
easy, okay. I mean, I was very competitive, a little psycho. Some people, like even my friends would say to me, don't hit me today. I'm like, I'm not hitting you. I'll hit your feet, you know? But yeah, and I was very different off the court in some ways. But on the court, anyone who didn't know me would be like, well, she's a bitch, you know. But then off the court, they're like, oh, you're just really nice. And I'm like, yeah, I'm very different off the court than I am on court. And I would absolutely say that about Novak. There's no question about it. And I think that, yeah, he's embracing the fact that now he doesn't have to prove anything to anyone.
True.
There's no doubt in my mind that everyone now knows and has said enough with the greatest of all time. This guy's stats, they just rule against everybody. I think he's going to play like this for another couple of years. He's taking care of his body so much. And I actually think him missing some of these tournaments because of the COVID situation has actually helped him.
Yeah.
Because it's allowed him to take time off, be around his family, spend some time with his kids, have a bit of normality, then go back and become that crazy, like, you know, obsessive, I'm going to win everything personality. And that's what he does better than anyone. So what he did this year was just incredible. I mean, I watched him play almost every one of those finals, the Grand Slams, and even the Wimbledon final was incredible. I mean, what, he has that swinging volley to probably go two sets to love at Wimbledon?
Well, and different also situation. The two backhands in the tiebreak, if he doesn't miss them.
I think it was the first time he'd made errors in a tiebreak in like a year.
Yeah.
Was that match?
Yeah.
But listen, he's just incredible. And you're right, he has adapted. He's coming into the net more. He does come into the net and serve and volley from time to time. And I think it's incredible what he's done. And you're right, he doesn't have that distinct, although great players do that, right? Like even Nadal, when he beat Medvedev in the finals of the US Open that time, he was starting to serve and volley all the time.
Yeah, exactly.
So great players like Nadal, like Novak, Roger, they do adapt to the people that they're playing against. And that's what makes them better players. And there's no doubt he's gotten better in every single aspect of his game. His serve is better. His forehand is better. His movement is as comparable as the best mover ever that we've ever seen. So, I mean, I don't know. He's just, I think we should embrace the fact that he's still around doing what he's doing and these young bucks are nipping at his heels and he's not letting go of them, especially in five sets. So a phenomenal year for Novak Djokovic. Again, three Grand Slams, finals of another, ATP finals. I think his only regret would be the fact that he actually lost the last two matches of the year and against Sinner in singles and doubles, which will hurt. Would have hurt him. As you know, he very much loves his country and representing it, and he probably wanted to finish that year because he said that if he wins the Davis Cup, it would be the best year of his career. Wow, that's something to say.
At 36 years old, and I'm 36. I know how my body feels. I would not be able to do what he does.
Do you think that he can – I know we're not really getting into next year, but what do you think his chances are of winning Grand Slam and the Golden Grand Slam? Because you know – in my opinion, it is going to be his absolute drive to win all four and the Golden Grand Slam because nobody's done that except Steffi Graf. And it's still probably the greatest thing that's ever occurred in tennis is winning a Grand Slam, calendar Grand Slam, and winning the gold medal in the same year.
So I will say something that I would not have said if Novak wasn't 36. I think this depends entirely on how the younger guys are able to close the gap, because I do think that age comes into play. Novak is not a mortal like we are. He's an immortal. He has a different type of body, a different type of mentality. He's just, as Nick Kyrgios would say, built different, except that Kyrgios uses it for himself, but Novak is actually built different. And so, but I do think that age comes into play at one moment. And as of now, the gap between Novak and the others is big enough that he can get away with being a bit older. And I think it will be up to the young guys now in this off season whether or not they can close the gap. If they can't, or if they can just a little bit, I think Novak has a shot. I would never go out on a limb and say he will do it for sure, because this is insane. Yeah. There's absolute insanity that Steffi Graf managed to do that. I also think it's much harder in nowadays era, because Steffi did have a few easy matches in beginning of the majors,
no question,
which is not possible anymore in that way.
And she won the gold after she won the slam.
Right.
The calendar Grand Slam.
Yeah.
So I think it was a little bit emotionally, a little bit easier for her. Because once she won the calendar Grand Slam, it's like, oh, this is cherry on top.
I do think that his fans have to be prepared for seeing him much less on tour. I think.
Oh, absolutely. I think he
will not play any tournaments anyway. Like,
I think he should do that.
Yeah, I think so too. I agree. I think that he will be very, very smart about his scheduling and that he will play as little as he needs to be prepared for the big tournaments and to be prepared physically and mentally to do what he needs to do. I do think that his main focus will be on the Olympic Games, because that's the one thing he doesn't have yet. So I do think if he will have to choose, if he will have to make adjustments depending on how his body feels, he will make those adjustments in order to be at a peak at the Olympic Games. That's my prediction. I obviously don't know, but that's what I think.
I agree 100%. It'll be interesting, isn't it? Because if he does do it, and we know that Nadal is planning on playing next year, and it's going to be at Roland Garros, it'll be interesting to see if they do play each other. And it's best of three sets, right, for the Olympic Games. So that is a little bit different. And I think that is actually what hurt him last Olympics when he was going for the calendar Grand Slam.
Well, in a terrible draw.
He was
draw.
So...
Didn't he have Del Potro in the first round?
No. We're talking Tokyo. Oh. Del Potro wasn't there.
Oh, right. He lost to Zverev.
But I think that court and the heat, and it was just not good for him. And I think he was exhausted after winning Wimbledon, and he knew that he was one Grand Slam away from winning the calendar Grand Slam, but he really wanted to play the Olympics because he wants that gold medal. And I think that fucked him up to winning the US Open because he was exhausted by the time he got to the final. I think he was mentally just fried and lost quite easily, not easily, but... for him easily to Medvedev. But I think that the best of three situation at the Olympics makes it even harder for him to actually do it, because these guys like Zverev, Sinner, Alcaraz, Runa, they can beat him over three sets because you can find lightning in a bottle for two sets.
Yeah.
It's really bloody hard to do, but you can do it. But best of five, that's a whole nother mental mountain to climb.
It's just the most amazing thing to me is these matches were like at the US Open when he's down two sets to love against Laszlo Djere, and Djere is playing so much better in those first two sets. I go to sleep, I turn off the TV, and I'm like, I know Novak is going to win this.
Yeah.
He's like 2-6, not winning, like losing his serve twice a set. And I go to say, like, yeah, he's going to win it.
Yeah.
and I wake up and it's like 6-2, 6-2, 6-1.
Yeah. It's like, I think the best thing to ever do when it comes to betting on tennis, just wait for Novak to get down two sets to love at a Grand Slam and then put your money on it, because you know he's going to come back and win. And you might get hit, you might get even money odds. two sets to love.
Yeah. We thank our sponsor betandwin.com. Thank you very much.
FanDuel, Penn, whatever it is that you DraftKings, whatever.
Well, but Novak's biggest achievement was not only his incredible successes on the court, but also being part of rivalries, which we love. And he was part of one particular amazing rivalry between him and Carlos Alcaraz, that Cincinnati match. I mean, I know the Wimbledon final, but also the Cincinnati match. There were just a few matches, even the Paris final, like Carlos faltered physically against Novak and mentally, but the first two sets they played was incredible.
Oh, in Paris, yeah,
can you talk a little bit on how you view their rivalry, and then also move into Carlos Alcaraz's season, a strange season, like with huge peaks, with like a next GOAT debate, and then a let off in the end of the season, the injury. So it was really everything in one bottle. He won six titles. He won Wimbledon. What did you make of his season?
Yeah, I mean, listen, this kid is so special. He's so great for the game. Smiling out there. I mean, the joy he has on the tennis court is so great to see. But the joy is almost what hurts him in a lot of ways, because he runs for too much. It's like he's jumping up and down. He's
losing too much energy, or what do you mean by that?
Yeah, I think he expends a lot of energy. I think that's what hurt him in Paris. Where he started cramping, the anxiety, he's just so up all the time.
He's so hyper,
and he's going to learn to temper that a little bit. And I think he did at Wimbledon. There's no question about that. He managed to temper down the personality a little bit.
I think sorry to interrupt you, but that when he won the semifinals against Medvedev, I was like, oh, I think he really wants to win against Novak, because he didn't celebrate. You know how normally he was kind of like...
It's so funny you say that.
He showed the fist... And he waved into the crowd, but then he kind of just packed his bag and left.
I tell you what, if anyone out there that does bet on tennis wants a little sort of thing to look at, is when people go absolutely bonkers when they win a match in the semis or a quarter, and they're like, it's almost like that was their tournament.
Right.
Where they're going.
That was the match.
You know, they're going over to hug their coach, and they're lying on the ground, and they're like crying. And I'm like, whoa, do you want to win the next match? Because that win should mean happiness, but not, you should not ever go over the top like with that sort of stuff. And I think when you see a player do that, that's done it before or done really well, and he'd won a slam before. He knows what it takes to maintain and control the ups and the downs. And my coach used to say to me one time, and again, I'm not comparing myself to any of these guys, but you know, when I made my first semifinal in doubles at Wimbledon, my coach said to me, "Okay, Grubbs, not too high, not too low, got another match ahead of you." And he had been in that situation with many other players before. And so that was a little wisdom that he passed to me, is that, look, yeah, it's great to be in the semis, but do you want to win the tournament? And it said, you know, those are little things like, well, remember when Sam Stosur made her first semifinal of the French Open and she was so excited. She wanted to go thank her friends and family for coming. And I was like, no, you're going to go ride the bike. You're going to stick to your routines and then you can go thank them later. But it's like when you haven't been there and it's almost like your tournament's over. Mm. So watch for a player. When they look like they mean business, it's because they mean business. Mm. You know, so there's not always. Some people can get really excited.
It can go off. There are other players on the other side of the court
who might
do the same thing.
Losing her mind after winning a quarter or a semi. Yeah. She's just like, does her twirl off the court because she's like, all she wants to do is win the tournament. Now, when she wins the tournament, she's on the ground and crying and all this sort of stuff. But, you know, that's a good mark for someone to look at to see if a player gets so excited to win a semifinal that you're like, they think their tournament's over. Mm. That's enough.
Let's talk about Carlos Alcaraz's game, right? We know he has it all, but we've seen him being rushed on that forehand side a bit, especially with players like Novak, who can take that backhand down the line really quickly, really early. He has that what Del Potro also had was, which
straight
makes
arm.
It so, but the straight arm, right? Yep. So when somebody gets you there quickly and deep and flat into that side, you can be a little late. What do you see for him? He looks like a very complete player. So what do you see for him to keep improving? Because the last part of the season, we saw it after the US Open, he was struggling with his game. Yep. Mentally is, of course, tennis is a holistic experience of a sport. Everything feeds into each other, the emotional side, the spiritual side, the mental
What's
side, and the game.
What's going on in your life? You don't know anything.
Exactly, you don't know that. But also game-wise, there were a few players who had figured him out, right? We saw Medvedev at the US Open semifinals, who really played a more aggressive style of game because he knew he had to. What do you make of his game? What do you think he can still improve and maybe adapt, because it seems so complete?
Yeah, I think you touched upon it already, the forehand. I think he needs to stay in it a little bit. I'd like to see him flatten it out sometimes as well. We know he has the power. Just look, there are times where he goes for a shot that's probably not on. It's still the youth, I think, in his game. If you look at the way he plays now, there are so many things that he can get a little bit better at. I think shot selection at times can be better, but that comes with age. That comes with experience. I think his serve can get better.
Yeah,
I think
too.
He can improve hitting it flatter. Look, he's not a big guy. But look, Novak, look at the way Novak played back when he was the same age. Mm-hmm. I mean, his forehand was dodgy. His serve was kind of shitty. Wasn't quite sure if it was going to go in half the time. You can't say that with Alcaraz. All of those things are much better at that same age. And then look where Novak is now. You know, the greatest player of all time with literally no weaknesses. I mean, the guy doesn't miss. No. So I think Alcaraz will get to that point because he'll realize that he doesn't need to go for that ball. He can stay in a rally a little bit longer. I think he can flatten the forehand out a little bit more. And I think overall, he just comes down to shot selection. Mm-hmm. And I think the forehand, like Novak's, like a lot of players. I mean, look how adaptive Nadal got on a hard court or a fast court. He stepped in a little bit, took taking balls earlier, serve and volleying sometimes, which Alcaraz does. I mean, his forward movement is fantastic. So I think it's just shot selection with him.
Maturity.
And maturity and knowing when to pull the trigger and when not to. And I think overall just that forehand, he'll get there. Mm. My biggest thing with him is the injuries.
Right.
That's what I'm concerned about because they're that groin injuries, like knee, like all that sort of lower body. And he's so athletic and throws himself around the court. So I think, if anything, he just needs to learn to taper down on that a little bit, get the training right, get the shot selection right, and we're going to see him around a long time.
Well, that's interesting that you say that because I knew a doctor who was like the most famous and most important horse doctor for racehorses, and he said something to me and it made me just think of Carlos Alcaraz, what you just said. He said to me that racehorses, yes, they are the maybe most athletic natural being that we have in the world, but they are so fickle because they are so athletic. If they get an inflamed hoof, right, they have to be killed. They have to kill them. I mean, it's true. They just have to put them down because they can't recover from that in a way because they are so...
No, they can't recover from that too because they need all their legs.
Yeah.
To stand on.
That's true.
There's a vet listening to this going, well, that's not necessarily...
Yeah, well, I did, that's how I remember it. Maybe he was just doing
no,
some
they
hyperbole.
Can't, they, no, it's
hyperbole.
True. No, they can't. They can't. They can't just put a horse in a cast and say, "Hey, don't walk on this." Mm-hmm. A horse can't understand you. Mm. So there's lots of reasons, but yeah, he's like a thoroughbred that needs to calm the fuck down. He needs to go into the pastures for a little bit. So, and I also think he needs to be a little bit more selective with his schedule. Mm. And you know, when you're young, you just think, "Oh, play, play, play." But I think he needs to get a little bit better with his schedule, which will allow him not to get injured a little bit more, I think, too. But he just physically puts everything into it. But our guy, who's now number 3 in the world.
Yes. Let's talk about him. Daniil Medvedev, 5 titles this year. Very interesting season. He had that stretch right before Indian Wells where he just seemed not able to lose.
Yeah, I don't know where he was. Yeah,
it was unbelievable.
Like, this guy's out of the top draw.
And he lost early at the Australian Open, which was strange for him. He lost to a good player, Korda, I think.
Yeah,
he lost to Sebastian Korda, which is, I mean, he was playing incredible at the beginning of the year. Sebastian got injured. Unfortunate that threw him off a little bit. But so it's not like he had a terrible loss, but I think people expect him on the hard courts to at least make the semis and finals. So what did you make of his season?
Well, I mean, shame that he didn't do better at the slams. I think he'd be a little disappointed with that. There's no question. But I think he sort of, towards the end of the year, we started to see why he's so good. He's just always there. You know what I mean? And he can beat anyone on any given day. Talk about embracing the fuck you to the crowd and things like that. I mean, his flip off to the Parisian crowd was hilarious. Where he's like, "What? I was just looking at my blisters on my hand." You're like, "No, dude, we saw you flip the crowd off." He entertains me. He loses his mind from time to time. I mean, his stuff at the ATP finals when he threw his racket, and then he's like, "Oh my god!" But he's entertaining and he's fun to watch. Talk about a different personality off the court too. He's always so nice off the court and always says hello. And but I just love Daniil. I love his game is so different and unique, and he's so aware of the fact that he feels really blessed to be where he is, that he struggled early on in his career. And he's like, "Look, I know that I went through a lot early on and I didn't think I could be this good, and now look where I am." And so I just love him. But you know, he played 22 tournaments this year. That's a lot.
That's a lot, yeah.
I mean, Alcaraz and Djokovic played 18.
Yeah, that's definitely a lot. What I love with Medvedev is two things. I think first of all is the thing that he really stands for, something that I love about tennis, that you can have your unique technique, unique style. It's like writers, they have their own type of prose, their
painters,
own style.
Yeah.
Painter, you know, when you see a Cy Twombly, you know it's Cy Twombly. When you see a Joan Jackson
Mitchell.
Pollock, you know it's Jackson Pollock. And when
you
hear
that
Bob
I said
Dylan.
Joan Mitchell, because I like to pick the women. You clearly go for the men. No surprise.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
And I think that's what I love about tennis, that you can, we talked about three players now, and all of them have their unique kind of thing going on, and all of it is successful in its own way. So that's what I really like about him. And one match I want to point out, I mentioned it before, semifinals, US Open against Carlos Alcaraz. He did do an adjustment to his game. That's just sometimes I feel like he relies too much on his defense and on being 20 feet behind the baseline. And that was the first time I saw him be like, no, dude, you cannot do that against Carlos Alcaraz. Yeah. You will be destroyed. Yeah. You need to be on the baseline. You need to return earlier and you need to make an adjustment. And he did, and it was successful for him. And I hope he takes a lot of confidence from that, that he can do it and that he doesn't rely too much on his great court coverage and just great eye for the game, right? But he sometimes against these players like a Jannik Sinner, like a Carlos Alcaraz, Novak Djokovic, yes, you need to step up a bit.
And that's what he did. Let's talk about the next guy, Jannik Sinner. He took it away from me, finally beat Medvedev because he recognized he had to be more aggressive. He had to take away sort of, you know, his ability to not miss a ball from the back of the court. And he's like, well, I'm not going to win the long ball rally, but I'm going to win the rally because I'm more aggressive and coming into the net and being
volleys,
a little bit.
Because
Medvedev, the one area that he could improve on is his volleys. Give me a goal. Because he is a little bit like, he's like a deer in headlights or a fish out of water at the net. He's just like, what am I doing here? What the fuck? He like runs back half the time. I'm like, no, stay there. You're fine. And he's like, no, I'm not. But that's an area that he could get better at, I think, to win against the Alcarazes and the Novaks going forward. I think he needs to improve his, because he doesn't miss from the back of the court. Imagine if he's hitting that flat, no high bouncing approach shot and actually learning how to hit a volley. And you can do that. I think Novak's improved that immensely since working with Boris Becker, with Ivanovic.
With
definitely
Ivanovic.
Not Ivanovic.
Novak, Goran, you didn't tell me that.
Ivanisevic. I think because those guys used to come into the net a lot, they have transformed his net play. And I think they've made Novak a better player at the net of understanding, because it's not about just volleying well. It's understanding when to come in, what to cover when you come in. That's something that Darren Cahill's absolutely helping Jannik Sinner with. You know, what do you approach on? What to look for when you approach a certain way. Like when you're a net rusher like I was, there's only so many angles and you can pick them and figure them out. You can learn how to move at the net to draw a certain ball at the net, for example. You just don't run in and like, you know, it's like split step. It's like, yeah, split step, but also sell one side, open up another. There's lots of ways to get someone to get better at the net, and I think that's where he could improve a little bit. Call me. Let's talk about
Jannik Sinner, 4 titles this year, and just notably, we talked about it in the last part, that great, great Davis Cup win, MVP. The only thing he did fall off a bit are the Grand Slams, the majors. Renee, can this Davis Cup win, because it is a different kind of pressure, he did not only well under this pressure, he did tremendously well under that pressure. Can that help him in the coming? I know you will do a look into the 2024 season, but what do you think it will do to him having won that Davis Cup and just a great end of the season now?
Well, hopefully it doesn't do what it did to FAA last year, because he finished the year unbelievable, won the Davis Cup and then stunk it up this year. I don't know what happened to Felix. I have a feeling I know what happened to Felix, but with Jannik, this is a different cat. Future world number one, there's no question. I think he will win a Grand Slam next year. If he doesn't, it'll definitely be in the next 2 years. He's so good. He has no weaknesses. He's improved his net play. His forehand is a lot more reliable. He's taken away a bit of the waggle with the backswing. His serve has improved immensely. Another thing that Darren has been working on is that, you know, his service motion, getting it more reliable. He moves unbelievable.
He's got stronger.
Dude, for 6 foot, what is he, 4? 6'4"?
He's quite tall, but he just has these really long legs, which is hard to run like that.
He's 6'2". He looks taller than 6'2".
He has become stronger. He has become more powerful.
Dude, he was an Italian champion skier. And when you're a good skier, your legs are fucking strong, okay? If you ever go and see a gym workout of a skier, most of their stuff is, you know, they're piling on weights on their to do clean and jerks and squats and, you know, pushing the fucking legs thingy, and they're doing these bouncing things up and down with the legs. All they're doing is crushing their legs every day. And so this guy grew up doing that. He doesn't look like it. His legs are like skinnier than mine. But it's like, well, maybe not. But listen, this kid can move. He stays down on his shots. And I think the one thing that he did not do well in the finals of the ATP final against Novak is you could tell he was really nervous, but he was coming out of his shots. So if you go and replay his matches, the shots he was missing, he wasn't missing earlier in the tournament because he was staying in with his legs. Now, was he tired? Probably. Was it physical for him? Probably. Was he nervous? Absolutely. And when you get nervous, what do? You come out of your shots with your legs because you start trying to use your hands because you're nervous. So I think the thing that he did better in the Davis Cup match against Novak is that he was loading the legs like crazy because he was rested more, right? He played a lot, singles and doubles, but he had days off in between, whereas ATP, he was playing every day, almost every day, but it was so intense. So I just think he is such a good player. He's improved every aspect of his game. His composure on court is amazing. I mean, when he won the match too at the Davis Cup, he was just like,
well, we heard it, Renee. You called him future number one in the world and possible 2024 Grand Slam champion, Jannik Sinner. This year, great win in Toronto, we should have mentioned, maybe his first 1,000 title. Let's move on to the Jesper Gula of the ATP Tour, yeah. As I like to call him. Poor Andrei Rublev, the quarterfinal king in the Grand Slams. He's so solid. He's so good. He's won two titles this year. He's just missing that extra little... It's like he's the best cupcake in the world, but they forgot to put the frosting on.
All the
you
sprinkles.
Know what I mean? The sprinkles, yes, because he has
frosting.
Yes, he has frosting. Just the sprinkles,
especially when you think about his hair.
Or but, do you think it's just that the other guys are that much better and it has nothing to do with him? Because I do love watching him play. I do think he's absolutely tremendous. If you ever have the chance to watch him in practice,
oh my god, it's awesome!
Please do that, because I've learned so much from Andrei Rublev. The way he accelerates just before he hits the ball, especially on the forehand, it's a beauty to watch, and I really love him. I love his personality. I love his game too. There's just those sprinkles missing. What are the sprinkles?
I tell you what the upset of the year is, though. Two players inside the top 10 with red hair. Red curly hair. I think the problem with Rublev is the mentality. And he's very one-dimensional. So when he's good, he's so good. And he's ripping balls all over the place. And he's clean, whacking people off the court. The problem is he hits the ball too flat all the time. Now you can say, well, Medvedev does too. Medvedev doesn't miss. I mean, Medvedev literally doesn't miss. And he's a lot more cautious than Rublev is. And I think that Medvedev has an underrated serve. But I also think that Medvedev is just methodical. He just picks you apart, waits. Which is why he always beats Rublev. Because he's... hits the ball similar to Rublev, just doesn't miss. Whereas Rublev gives you a little bit of miss, but he's crazy. I mean, he's nuts. He loses a point. He could be up a set and it could be 3-all in the second. He loses one point at like 30-all and he fucking goes crazy. He starts yelling at his people. It's like, mate, listen. And listen, those that lived in glass houses, I mean, I was a little crazy on the court. But it's like at some point you're like, that's hurting you. So I think he got a lot better at it this year. But I think that's where he needs to improve. And he's a little bit too one-dimensional. And so I think against the Alcarazes and Jannik Sinners and Medvedevs and Novaks is that they just wait for him to implode, or they sort of just figure him out that he's going to make an error at some point. And so that's what they take advantage of. Having said that, what a great year. So I'm super happy. I love the guy. I love watching him play. He's a lot of fun. Please, God. Who's going to... Okay, so give me your guess. Who's going to make a semifinal first, Pegula or Rublev?
Rublev.
Oh, okay.
I think that he...
I say Pegula.
Okay, nice. I like
we're shaking on that.
I like both. I think that Rublev, I just looked at his results. He was also a bit unlucky in those quarters. He tends to end up against Novak. I think he lost twice.
Either
or three
Novak
times.
Or Medvedev.
Exactly. So, that you know, if he got somebody that... I mean, we see it. There are people in the court. He could have gotten a Ben Shelton. He could have gotten a Tommy Paul. It's not like you always need to play Novak Carlos or in the quarters. You can be a bit lucky, but he hasn't been lucky. So I think that I think his quality of play is there. It's just I think the others that we just talked about are just a bit ahead of him. I think he needs a actually agreeing with you. I think he needs to open up angles more because he tends to hit through the court a lot. So if you have good movers who tend to make the balls
he never beats
over
Medvedev.
And over. Yeah.
Because he's literally hitting the ball so hard and Medvedev's 20 feet behind the
and
ball.
And he needs to get to the net. I think in the men's, you can't. To beat the best of the men. In women, you can get away with it. But I think to beat the best on the ATP side, you need to be able to finish at the net, because a Medvedev, even a Carlos Alcaraz, they will just run you down until you miss. And you will not maybe miss at 6-3, 3-all, but you will miss at 5-all. And then it sits in your head and it grows and it pesters like a virus. And you know what happens when we have viruses, then we get vaccines and some people don't want to get the vaccine. And then we're all in a mess. Then we're all in a pickle and we don't want that.
Yeah.
Let's move on to a very strange season, Renata. On number 6...
Steph Tsitsipas.
Paula Badosa's boyfriend. Paula Badosa's boyfriend, well, Stefanos Tsitsipas.
His year was better than hers.
Yeah, Paula unfortunately injured. Hopefully she can bounce back. Had the stress fracture in a lower back. So hopefully she can be healthy, and because I love watching her play. He has won title this year and he has played the final at the Australian Open, lost to Novak there. What did you make of his season? It was a strange one.
He played 24 tournaments. And Rublev played 25 tournaments. Holy they're playing a lot.
Yeah.
Tsitsipas, he's just, you know, look, the bottom line is great serve, great forehand. Backhand is attackable. So anytime you play against these great players in the semis, finals, they're going to find a way to beat you because they're going to play that backhand. You're not going to be able to hurt them. So just like Maria Sakkari, I don't know if it's a Greek thing, but he's got to get his backhand better and he's got to get his slice backhand better because his slice backhand is so shit. And I'm talking about on the level it needs to be to do well. And he needs a slice backhand because it's going to set up the forehand. So his slice backhand is so bad. He comes out of it with his left leg. I don't know why someone hasn't like helped him with that shot. But the bottom line is he needs to improve his slice backhand because his toppy is okay when he has time. But when someone attacks it, he needs to be able to play a better slice.
You mean to slow the game down in a way so he can use his forehand again?
To slow it down, but to put it in a position, i.e. down the line, like Roger used to be able to slice your backhand down the line. And so when someone runs over there, when the ball's a foot off the ground, it's really hard to go back down the line.
So they go cross court, it's to his forehand.
Bang. You know, so he needs to improve that side of his game. Mm-hmm. And if he doesn't, he's going to be a good player for the rest of his career. And he's never going to win a Grand Slam. And I've said this for, I didn't even know.
You don't
know.
Think he's going to win a Grand Slam?
No. And I'll tell you why. Because I don't think he's going to win a Grand Slam with his dad coaching him.
Okay.
And I know he had that little run with Philippoussis this year and whatever. But he needs to just literally redo his entire team and tell his dad and mum to stay home. And it's nothing to do with the fact that I don't think his dad can coach or is a good coach. But he's not your coach that you're going to win a Grand Slam because he's so volatile, so toxic. The relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Now, off the court, they could be best friends. But you know this, Petko. Your dad was a tennis coach. Mm. It's fucking too hard. If you have a very volatile relationship on the tennis court, at some point it's not a positive thing under serious duress. And that's what semis and finals of Grand Slams are.
Do you think Stefanos Tsitsipas has stagnated in his
play? Yes. I think he has stagnated. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that his dad is still his coach and he can't just go away with somebody else and say, here are your issues. Someone like a Darren Cahill will be like, well, I'm going to break you down your slice. I'm going to help you with this. I'm going to help you tactically. And you'll be a better player because of that. But his dad he's hit the plateau with his dad. That's how I feel. Anyway, let's move on from Steph.
Let's move on. I just want to shout out one thing that I think he does maybe with Carlos Alcaraz the best in the top 10. And I just wanted to shout it out because we don't see it that much often anymore. Hits his transfer when he gets a short ball, how quickly he gets up to it and moves through it and ends at the net very naturally is really a beauty to watch. And I love to watch him when he's playing well. Whenever you drop a ball short,
boom, he's up there.
He's there.
But
he takes it on the rise and he's at the net and he's always in the right place. And we don't see that much anymore. So, and I never knew how to do it. That's why I think I just love to watch it in that way. So I just wanted to shout out that thing that I think he does maybe the best in the top 10.
Well, which is why his slice can help him. Because if he slices really well, just like Roger, where he manipulate the slice, hit it short, hit it deep, just like Alcaraz does from time to time, most of the time they go to your forehand after that. They'll try and go to his backhand, but you know that. So when you're a heavy forehand player like an Ash Barty, you know when they're going to go back to your backhand. You can step around, hit an inside-out forehand, boom. points over. So anyway,
Renee,
do we have to talk about the numbers?
Okay, so number seven is Alexander Zverev. I think the way I want to handle it, let's just stay strictly with the tennis. Let's not talk about anything else, because I think enough has been said about that. Alexander Zverev, he has won two titles this year. He won in Hamburg, in his hometown. He, it has to be said, he had a tremendous comeback on the tennis court, because thinking of the beginning of the year, he was nowhere near his best. Had this
Do you know how many tournaments he played? Take a guess.
I would say 28.
Close. 27. Mm. What the fuck?
Well, he's coming back from injury.
That's true.
He always likes to play a lot anyways. But are you watching him? Can you still watch him? What do you make of his game? I was there. I'm a tournament ambassador at the Hamburg tournament, so I watched his tennis there, and I think he's played the best I've ever seen him play there, especially in the final against Laszlo Gere. So I do think he's back to his old self, maybe even better. He has a new fitness coach by his side, a Croatian guy who is really, really good. He used to be with Miloš Raonic. I'm sorry, I'm blanking on the name. But yeah, just give us your thoughts.
If you're blanking on it, I have no chance.
let's try and stick to the tennis facts with Zverev, and just give us your thoughts on his game.
Do I have to? Okay.
You don't have to. You can
no,
just
listen,
say
his
two
tennis,
sentences.
There's no question his tennis has improved, like, outrageously. This year, he's coming back from that injury. There's no question he had to find his feet, no pun, and his legs. But overall, I think, look, he's hitting the ball great, and he's always going to be a threat. He's not double folding 20 times a match anymore, so he's kind of curtailed that a little bit, and I think that's helped him. But again, you know, it's just... He will be a threat next year. There's no question at Grand Slam play. And the reason
I
he'll
actually
be a threat
think
is
he can win Roland Garros at one point. I don't know if next year, but I think that he will have
sure.
a shot there.
Well, he thought he could win it when he twisted his ankle against.
Well, he moves
Nadal.
The best on clay
Nadal.
For his size.
Yeah.
He has a great serve, and the weird forehand that he has, that spinny forehand that goes out into the angle.
Yeah.
It's really. Good discomfortable on for to play on clay because it like sits up.
Yeah.
It has a lot of rotation but not a lot of power, and so you really have to
generate your own stuff,
and it's not easy to handle. And I've seen it over and over again on clay. The guys don't really know what to do it because it lands quite short in the court, but it goes out, so you don't have an angle to actually attack it because you're out of place. He moves well. If you go down the line, he has the best shot in the world. His running backhand is insane.
Oh my god, his back and is so good.
So I think that strange forehand that hurts him on the hard courts and can hurt him when it gets tight and it gets really short on clay is actually kind of a weapon. Not a weapon, let's not go that far.
It's
but
like
it's very
like Coco's.
Weird to play.
Coco's better forehand on clay because she can just hit that toppy down the line and then you go to her backhand just like Zverev and then he just goes, thanks, I've control of the point now. But look, you know, all the stuff that's happening off the court, he's going to have to deal with that too. All right, let's get to number eight, Holger Rune.
Yeah, what do you
what
make
a strange
of him?
Year too for him.
So
he played 23 tournaments in the year, which
the men are
lot.
Quite yeah. they like to play tournaments.
Yeah.
What is up with that?
I don't
do
know.
Do they get good appearance fees?
Clearly they do. But look, Holger Rune, I think what was good for him is that he had a struggle town on the hard courts. He played pretty well at the Grand Slams, quite well,
yeah.
especially for someone young. But I think
except for the U.S. Open, yeah. where he lost first round,
well, that
the
was
famous.
Terrible. Well, that's what I'm saying.
Put me on a court where nobody can watch, and then
I was
first
there.
That, round.
I watched
if he had
match.
Won that match, that would have been cool. But losing that match is kind of awkward. When you tweet that out, can you tell us what happened? Exactly?
Well, that's the thing. When I read it, I was like, "Oh, dude, he's going to lose this match because he's already like saying how pissed he is at being." I mean, I will say.
But
this.
Apart from that, he has had a good Grand Slam run, like a decent
good.
Grand Slam run.
I will say this about that. When I did see that schedule, I did think it was kind of shitty as well.
Yeah,
we all
okay.
know those courts there.
Oh, I like that because I think that we always, when players, not always, we sometimes when players
complain.
Voice their grievances, we tend to be like, you're privileged. Fuck, how can you have any complaints? But I like that you say when you looked at it, you also thought it was strange.
No, I thought it was a slap in his face. I think
okay.
he was four in the world. I think he was number four seed playing on court five. Like, we know those courts.
Mm.
Those courts are really hectic. There's a match going on next to you. There's a match going on next to you there.
It's a row of four.
It's,
so for those who haven't been at the US Open, it's a row of four or three
courts.
Yeah,
like, you don't even know if your court's the one getting called
yes.
out. You're
yeah,
like,
that's
was that
true.
My court?
That's true. They are stacked next to each other. And I watched Ayla's first match back after her injury, Ayla Tomljanovic's. And she was playing in the
middle.
in the middle, and next to her was playing Jenny Brady, and I kept thinking they called balls out, which was on the court next door. So I do have to say, it's a
well, and also, mate, it's like you could, there's no public out there. I mean, yes, those courts get packed.
Yes,
because they're small and they're all next to each other. Yeah. It's a great place to go and see it.
If you, for fans, it's the coolest. Best. It's yes, the best. If you sit up on the stands, but you can watch three matches at the same time.
There is literally maybe 1,000, no, not even 500 people watching him play. Come on, he's the fourth player in the world. He's having a great year. Fucking come on, put him on court 7. Put him on the court you played your last match. Like, yeah, that's a big stand at least. Like, really? Court 5? Anyway.
So, I appreciate you saying that,
besides
actually.
Besides that, I think the best move he made was getting rid of certain coaches and bringing on Patrick Mouratoglou. Sorry.
Calm down, okay?
Sorry. I meant getting rid of Patrick Mouratoglou and bringing on Boris Becker.
That's a Freudian slip, Renee. That is a Freudian slip. I didn't know you felt that way.
Caitlin, if you're listening to this,
Are you starting a comeback with Patrick Mouratoglou?
Edit that out. Okay? No. Boris Becker, I think that was a great move from him. Look, Boris has been in jail. He's been through some tough times. He's also a former great.
All the Germans with the controversies.
Yeah, what's up with that? What have you done lately? But, you know, the fact that, look, Boris has achieved what he achieved at such a young age as well. So he's sort of lived this life that Rune's living, but even more so because if anyone saw the documentary, whoa, there's things that he had to go through as an 18-year-old. But I think Boris has lived such a life. He's been around. He's achieved so much himself. He was terrific for Novak. And Novak will tell you that, you know, he was great. And I think that he's that type of personality. And you know Boris. Mm. He's not into hyperbole, and he's going to tell Rune to shut the fuck up.
Yeah.
Stop complaining.
I know Boris very well, and he's a very strong personality in a sense. He's a very, if that's still possible.
But he's emotional.
Yeah, but if that's still possible, he's the best possible alpha male, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like that's nowadays, that's kind of an insult, but I mean it in a good way in this case. Yeah. He's very sure of himself. He knows who he is. He likes who he is. He has a lot of confidence, a lot of inner confidence. And I think it might have been shaken by everything that has happened, but he doesn't need the job in that way, right? Because
he wouldn't mind a little money.
Yeah, I mean, this is really complicated, but I think that's why he also handled being with Novak so well for so long, same as Goran Ivanišević, because you have to be a strong personality to handle these really ambitious guys who know what they want and are just like pit bulls. When they want something, they don't let go.
If you have a coach that you can tread all over, you lose respect.
Yeah.
You don't respect what they're saying to you. You've got to have that ability as a coach, no matter who you're coaching, to be able to step up and say, I think this is the best thing for you. And never doubt what you're saying to your player. And Boris, is that going to be that person for Rune? And he's already improved under him.
Yeah,
you
can
tell he's controlling himself better on the court. He's becoming less controversial. He's sort of doing the right thing. And I think Boris is going to be a great influence for Rune. I think Rune is going to have a really big year next year. Just like Świątek in a lot of ways, I think he learned a lot about himself this year, about how to deal with
the famous sophomore slump, maybe, in a way.
Well, in some respects, but also, I mean, look, Iga is clearly way more accomplished. But I think just learning to deal with adversity as a young player, learning from it and becoming better. And I think he did that this year. I think he's finished the year. He pushes Novak every time he plays. He has tremendous respect for Novak. I think Novak is certainly somebody he looks up to. I think that he would have learned a lot from it this year. And I think that I think he's matured a little bit over the last couple of months. I think actually him playing like shit for a little while has actually kind of humbled him somewhat. And I think that he got back to really doing what's important. And look, I'm famous for saying, or infamous for saying, he has a punchable face. Okay, there were times on court that I said that he is a bit of a punchable face.
I mean, I said it
in jest, but I actually have to say, I think he's improved a lot on the court, and I kind of like him now. I think he's turned a little bit of a corner, and I think he's going to have a great year next year. So let's get to the nicest player on
tour.
Well,
I have to say one thing about Holger Rune. I always liked him because I love the rebels on court. I love when they, you know, are kind of street fighters. I will say he has to figure out what is going on with his body, because he is losing substance in the third set.
Yeah.
We're on the ATP tour. You need to be able to sustain 5 set matches, have a day rest, and come back and play again if you want to win a slam.
Especially
and
when
he needs
young.
To figure
Doesn't
out.
Need to practice.
He's cramping, and I know genetically some people are just prone to cramping more than others, but he needs to have a good medical team in place and figure out what the hell is going on with his body, because that needs to become better. I think his tennis is tremendous. I love watching him play. And you're right, Hubie Hurkacz, two titles, and I don't have a lot to say about him except that I like him.
Oh my God, I love him. He's literally, other than Jannik Sinner, could be, as far as top 10 are concerned, just my favorite person and player. There's one indelible moment to me when he walked out to the crowd at Washington, D.C. last year, not this year, last year. He was the top seed, I think, or two seed. And it was like 12 o'clock in the middle of the day, and you have played in Washington, D.C., where it's literally 105 degrees in the middle of the day. Nobody is there watching the tennis on center
so
court because it's so hot. It gets packed. It's sold out every – so I don't want to diss on DC because it's literally one of the best tournaments of the year. But, you know, people have a tendency not to come watch those first early matches, right, because people have jobs as well. There was like five people in the crowd, and he walks out and he literally smiles and waves as he's walking out there. And I'm just like, oh, I fucking love this guy.
He smiled and waved at every single person that was
so
there,
classic.
At the five people that
you know,
were there.
He's just got that. He's like, he reminds me of a 5-year-old in a 25-year-old man's very tall body. You know, he just has those like pigeon-toed walk, and he just battles. He comes in. I just love him.
Do you see him progressing in his tennis play?
I see him being this player forever.
Okay.
Winning a Masters 1000 every now and again, getting to semis of a slam. He certainly can. Winning one, I don't think he can win one, but I see him doing very well for his career. I think him being a perennial top 10, top 20 player for his entire career, because he loves the sport, and he works really hard, and he doesn't have a lot of weaknesses. It's just that I think the other guys are just a little bit better under pressure from time to time. He gets a bit choky, but I love him. And is there a guy that plays more fucking three set matches or wins more matches in tie breaks?
Well, that's the interesting thing, because he chokes when he's up, and then he plays okay in the tiebreaks, which is like, bro, it's easier to play when you're up 5-2 than when you're 5-all in the third set tiebreak.
No,
like,
he just, I don't know, but I love him. He's my favorite player.
I like him too. I like him too. Let's go on to the last
player
in the top 10. It's Taylor Fritz. He also had two titles. Interesting season. He needs to figure out his Grand Slam performances, Renee, doesn't he?
Well, the thing is, and I've said this over and over about him, Taylor played 26 tournaments this year, which is a lot, but a lot of that had to do with him trying to make the ATP finals as well at the end of the year. But I think the problem for...
Let's talk about this. Make your point, and then we'll talk about this after. I have a question about that.
I think the thing with Taylor is the reason he doesn't do well at slams. And listen, this is a guy that did well at Wimbledon, lost that really tough match against Nadal a couple of years ago. But I think the problem with Taylor is that he loses his shit, like Rublev, from time to time. He's complaining to his box all the time. And I like Taylor a lot. Like, I actually like him. Talks really well when you interview him. He understands the game. He's a nice guy off the court. He treats people well. But fuck, on the court, like yelling and every point, like looking at his box, like putting his hands up and complaining. It's like, dude, if you want to do well at Grand Slams, you have to learn to calm the farm and shut your mouth when it comes to playing best of five. Because all the emotion that you're giving out negatively all the time is going to come back to bite you when it really counts. There's a reason why Novak, you know, Novak can do it from time to time, but he's been doing it and he's won 20, how many Grand Slams? Like, let that guy can do whatever he wants. He knows how to win. You need to stop emoting negativity when you are playing tennis. And it starts on the practice court, then you take it onto the matches, and that would be the first thing that I would say to him. I want you from day one at your first match at every Grand Slam, I don't want to see a negative reaction from you. And let's see how you do. And if you don't do well, you can do whatever the fuck you want every single match going forward. But as a coach, I'd be like, if you gesture to me something negative at 5-all in the first set, when you just lost 1 point, you know, you missed a forehand by half an inch, and you gesture anything to me like, oh, it's missed by, I'm leaving.
Yeah.
So you've got to be tough like that as a coach. And Mike Russell's done a great job with him, but it's like, man, that's the biggest issue for him. And this is somebody who's in the top 10 in the world. And I give him great credit because he's had a great year. But man, that's the one thing, that's the one knock on him at Grand Slams. That's what needs to get better for him to get to a final of Grand Slam.
Yeah, I think he also needs to work on his first serve a bit and second serve. Both serves, like when it's good, but he sometimes loses timing on it. He throws it up very high, so when he loses the timing, he tends not to make first serves in important games. So there are a few things in his game as well that I think that he can get better, apart from the emotions. I will ask one question that I was very surprised about, his, because we talked about it a few times today, how important scheduling is and how it's part of being a tennis professional and being one of the best 10 players in the world. He scheduled to play all the tournaments on the US Open series to go into the US Open. Yeah. My thinking is, if you're a top 8 player as an American, he ended up in the top 10, but he was in the top 8 coming into the US Open. When you're a top 8 player in the US at the US Open as an American, you want to win.
Yeah,
you might not. You might lose, even lose first round, but you have to plan for this Grand Slam, for this major, as if you are going to win. Can you win a major that lasts 2 weeks, where you play in the worst heat, the worst humidity, against the best players in the world, in the jungle that is New York City, with playing 5 tournaments in a row before that? I don't think you can.
He played 5 tournaments?
I don't know. Atlanta, he played Washington DC, he played Toronto, he played Cincinnati, and I think he was scheduled to play Winston-Salem, and then he pulled out. So
yeah,
he was scheduled
so
to play 5, and he played 4.
That's so dumb. Well, you know, Cincinnati and Canada are mandatory,
right?
So
he
has to
play
those.
Atlanta and Washington.
Yeah, so he won Atlanta.
He
then
played
he
Washington.
So I'm sure he got paid to go to Washington. But yeah, you're right.
But
that's
do
so
you want
true.
To win a major, or do you want to get paid to play in Washington? Is the question I have.
Yeah, well, you're telling me what he needs to do. And
I'm not
true.
Telling you what he needs to do.
No,
every
I think
player,
that's, I agree with
every
you.
What I want to say by that is not, I'm not faulting or judging Taylor Fritz. He's an adult man. He can do whatever he wants. And he has a great career, has a great life. He's earning great money. And I will say, he is one of the most competitive guys. I love his attitude. He has worked
when
so
he's
hard.
Shit.
Right, but he never gives up. He has no ego. He always fights. Like, I have tremendous amount of respect. The thing what I'm asking by that is not a part of a judgment. It's a glimpse into his mentality. Does he actually believe that he can win the US Open? Because if he did, maybe he would have scheduled differently. I don't know. I'm just asking. This is a question I'm genuinely asking. Maybe you have the answer to that.
I think that him going to Atlanta was okay because he lost early, terribly, at Wimbledon, where he lost to Michael Emer in the second round. So he had a lot of time. So he went and won Atlanta, which is great. Then the thing that he should have done then is not play Washington. Although, you know, he probably thinks, all right, I'm getting my confidence back. Maybe if I win Washington, he lost to Griekspoor in the semifinals, 6-2 in the third. So maybe if he wins Washington, then he goes into those tournaments. Maybe he pulls out of Canada. I don't know. Or maybe
but
then he
said
loses
it,
second round.
Washington, D.C. is the worst tournament to play of the year. Conditions-wise, it's the hottest, most humid.
He would have played a lot of matches. He lost at night, though, I think, because he was one of the draws.
You still lose a lot of substance there. You sweat so much. It's not easy to recover from that tournament.
So he lost in the semis to Griekspoor. He lost in the round of 16, then in Canada to Alex de Minaur. And then he lost to Novak in the quarters in Cincy, and then he didn't play to the US Open. But you're right, that's actually figuring it out. And then he actually played really well at the US Open. He didn't lose a set, so everyone was like, oh, this is the time.
Yeah.
And then he got crushed by Novak in 3 sets. So he has to figure out that, but that's what I'm saying. For me, it's his emotional ups and downs. And I would like to actually go back and look at the matches that he played against those players, that he won every match in 3 sets, in straight sets.
Yeah.
How emotional was he throughout that? Like, because so that, those are little things that I would look at as a coach for him. And then where does Novak pick him apart? Well, I mean, other than everywhere. So anyway, so let's get to who we think surprises.
Players that were either surprises or that were memorable to you. And I have a few on my list. What comes to your mind when you think of players outside of the top 10 that somehow grasped your attention in one way or another?
Well, listen, we have to talk about Ben Shelton. And a lot of
very
people
exciting
have,
young
a lot
player.
Of people have asked me, you know, who's the American that's going to win a slam if they do? And I do think that Ben Shelton is that player. I think why? Because he has the weapons. Mm. He has huge serve. His forehand's huge. And the thing that he's gotten really good at, and much better at, that he did it even at the start of the year, we had a great Australian Open, is his backhand has got more reliable, because his backhand at the Australian Open, I was like, oh God, it's so bad. I mean, it was so bad. But, you know, look at Sam Stosur. Sam's backhand was not great, but she started to not miss it when she was playing at her best. And then her forehand, her serve was so dominant.
Yeah. When she was playing her best, she had that little backhand down the line pass. Because you would know that normally if you attack her on the backhand, you would get an opening. But that when she was playing well, she really played it so flat and almost short into the court. And if you don't have great volleys, which most women don't, it was really hard.
It's called a nice little slice short, or she would smack the backhand down the line.
Yeah.
And a lot of women didn't cover that shot enough. So with Ben, I think he's improved his backhand so much. He's not making a lot of errors on it. And then everywhere else is so good. And he hits the shit out of the ball.
And he's really a specimen physically.
And I tell you what.
He has the most explosive muscles I've seen in a long
time.
And
he's cocky, which is important.
Yes, attitude.
But also the thing that I think he got better at, even at the end of the year, because, you know, he had that great Australian Open. Played very average after that. Mm. Couldn't win two matches in a row.
Is average US Open a euphemism for bad?
Yeah.
Because he didn't win a match.
Yeah. But no, he didn't win two matches in a row. And then he had a great US Open. But the thing that impressed me the most was his end of the year, how well he played in China. Mm. And the thing that, talking about, remember we were talking about how people get super excited when they win a match? You know, and he had the phone thing that, you know, put the phone down. He stopped doing that after a while. And I think he started to learn that, you know what, this is about me winning. Mm. And getting respect, and he won his first ATP title. And I think that what I saw from Ben was no mistakes on the backhand, huge weapons, but his mentality was very good. Mm. Like, he'd win matches against really good players in quarters and semis, and he would just be like, yep, shake hands and walk off.
I like that, because he kept the cockiness in a way inside him as an energy that he can channel to actually put the phone down, not physically doing it, but just like actually put the phone down, meaning winning matches. Yeah. And I think you're right. He really channeled that cockiness into positive energy that he used to play.
So kudos really to him great. And all the American guys who are pushing each other. And it's about time they've caught up to the women.
And I think you will talk about that, because I had it as a talking point. And I was like, I think that should be something for you and Caitlin when you look towards the 2024 season, because I think that's going to be really interesting. Who is going to end up US's number one on the men's side? You mentioned
so
it earlier. There are five in the top 25, and it's really incredible to witness. Who else did you? So I'm
That's
just going to throw in.
Okay,
so I'm going to throw in two. I'm going to throw in, and we don't have to talk about them for a long time. I just want to throw them in. Matteo Arnaldi, who beat. We talked about it. Who beat
Alex
the Australian
Popperin.
Alex Popperin? I just love his game. I love how he plays. He hits so hard, and he's so skinny. I'm like, where's this energy coming from? Where's the power coming from? All these skinny, dainty little Italians. I love them. And I have to give a big shout out to Grigor Dimitrov, because I think he really had a tremendous comeback. It's bad in a podcast to do.
He had long COVID.
Well, but it's bad in a podcast to do signals with your hands, air quotes. So I'm doing air quotes. Come back, because he was around, but he was struggling. And this year, I think he really found his form again, played some great matches. And as we know, always a guy for the highlight reels. And I really enjoyed seeing him back at his best. But he had long COVID.
He had long COVID. I spoke to him quite a lot at the start of the year. And he just said, look, I struggled so much. Like, I couldn't, because he got COVID a couple of times. And he's like, I couldn't do the physical work in the gym. And we know how important his legs are. And how quick he is around the court. So it was really nice to see him. And I did, when I remember when I saw him in Washington this year, or maybe it was at Wimbledon, I hadn't seen him for a couple of months, and I went, oh my God, you look so much stronger physically. Like, his chest was a little bit bigger. He was just stronger, and you could tell. And so he needs that to do better. And so hopefully he can have another really good year next year and keep the momentum going. He just doesn't quite have it against the top guys, you know, like Novak, and when they're on, but certainly push them all this year. So it was really nice to see.
Any tournament or competition that stood out to you on the ATP side in any form or way?
I mean, listen, I loved to see Novak do what he did again this year. It was unbelievable. Just to do it at his age and just embrace embrace that side of him,
the villain era.
But I loved the final at Wimbledon, and you know, the final, it was, I was there live watching it, and it was just atmosphere, and the tennis was just unbelievable. It was so great. But just overall, Jannik Sinner's rise to the top at the end and what he did, and it's just the top 10 guys, the top three or four guys are so good. You mentioned that you didn't think that the depth was there in the men's game as much as the women's, but look, overall the men's was an entertaining year in the fact that Novak won everything again. Just kidding. And so we'll see. We'll see how much.
Say, you know, in soccer, they used to say about the German team, they're in soccer, 11 men play against 11 men and Germany wins in the end. And it feels like that on the ATP tour for the last year. Like everyone is fighting for the title and in the end, Novak wins.
So anyway,
I have to say it was a really exciting year. I think the just Novak dominated, but just the glimpse of a future where there are young guys who can challenge him and who are setting up for interesting rivalries to come was very exciting. And I think that's why a lot of people jumped on that Carlos Alcaraz and Yannick Sinner
train. You have to admit, Roger and Rafa made Novak the player he is now.
100%.
He had to be.
They all made each other into the players.
And I would say, arguably, that the Runas, the Alcarazes, and the Sinners in particular, and the Rublev from time to time, they are making Novak even better because they are as quick as him. They have, I mean, the variety that Alcaraz has made Novak anticipate hitting drop shots and coming to the net and all that sort of stuff. The power that Sinner has, Novak has to flatten out the forehand. Yeah. He has to come into that.
He played much more aggressive in that ATP final.
And he can play
on
any surface, Novak. So, I don't know. I'm loving it. These guys are catching up. They're still not there yet, as he says. The kids aren't there yet. So, anyway, it was great year on the men's tour. We can't wait for the Australian Open to start. Caitlin and I are going to do a live podcast the 17th of December in New York City. So if you're in the tri-state area or in the area, jump in a car or train, pop up here. We're going to have a live podcast. Sadly, Petco won't be there. She'll be back.
I won't be there, but thank you so much for having me. This was a pleasure. Hey. And see you next year for a wrap-up of 2024,
Muchas
if we're still alive.
Gracias. Dankjewel in Dutch. I would just say thank you, Petco, for always being my friend and coming on the podcast. We love you. And how's retirement? Just real quick. Fun?
Yeah, good.
Doing this. All right, guys. Thanks for joining us again for the wrap up of the men's. And we'll hear from you you'll hear from us real soon.
Cheers.
Bye. Cheers.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.